The Guardian.
Football Weekly with James Richardson.
Football Weekly. Good weekend for Arsenal fans everywhere, with perhaps that one exception in Pakistan, as Gunners take down leaders. Arsenal's form may have taken longer to find than Osama bin Laden, but now they're back in the title hunt a little bit. And so are Chelsea, who next weekend, fresh from beating Spurs, face off for the title at Old Trafford. One word, woof. Elsewhere, the race for fourth, the relegation battle. We round up all the latest with three games to go and get the news from abroad too. Spain, Clásico número cuatro. This time it's personal. Real report six Barca players to UEFA and ask to have their ball back. The pod asks, how low can Real go and how will UNICEF retaliate? France, the blanker than blanc quota scandal at the FA. Italy, Milan, just a point from the title, but Silvio's already got the party started. Plus, back in the top flight, maybe Queen's Park Rangers. All that, plus your post in today's Football Weekly. Hello, everybody. Yes, on board today, Greg Ruffley.
Hi, James.
Paolo Bandini.
Hello.
And Paul Doyle.
Hi, James.
Hi, Paul. Still rubbing your eyes in amazement after an extraordinary weekend in the Premier League and beyond.
That's right. And right. Fatigue.
Yes, and fatigue.
Yeah.
But it's quite thrilling, isn't it, to be involved in a story like this?
Well, my involvement is quite minimal.
Is it?
In fairness.
Greg, your involvement very much with a capital I.
Oh, yeah. With the
And you were there as well, weren't you, Paolo?
Yeah, I was there, yeah.
All right, but I said Greg first. So.
Yeah. I drove down 5 hours from Liverpool to be involved.
Yeah, that's how committed fantastic. I am. All right, excellent. And you were rewarded with historic stuff, an Arsenal win. They took the lead, they kept the lead, and they threw the title race wide open.
Well, they did, yeah. And the funny thing is, they just didn't look weighed down by expectation. They'd already blown the title chances previously, so they held the ball well. They knew when to up the pace, and they just had a lot of energy in midfield and far more than Man United did.
Paolo, was it just that, the fact that there were no expectations? Was that the difference?
It was a funny thing. I was just saying this to Greg, coming out of the stadium, you talk to all the Arsenal fans there and you got such a range of reactions. I mean, generally people were obviously pretty happy at beating United, but more than one person came to me and was saying, oh, you know, I'm actually really hacked off. God, I wish we hadn't gone today almost, just because I'm so annoyed that, you know, this now says what we could have done if we, imagine what we could have done if we'd won those games before. But I think there's also a sense of realism there in people knowing that if they had won those games before, perhaps indeed they would not have played with as relaxed a manner as they did this weekend.
Is there any fear that yesterday's performance and victory might convince Arsene Wenger that he's on the right track after all, and these players are finally coming good, and so they'll be the business next season?
I think that's almost exactly the point, is that some people sort of feel like this is now going to allow Wenger to sweep away all the stuff that's gone wrong and just go, well, look, you know, everything's fine again.
But I mean, without wishing to be devil's advocate, you're looking at a team yesterday that now has found a keeper, now apparently has found a midfield too. Is Wenger on so very much the wrong track?
No, I mean, look, you know, Wenger's never been miles off the track, because obviously they wouldn't be that close to the top of the table if he had been. You know, there's obviously been a lot said about losing all these leads, but when it's all said and done, Arsenal have still come pretty close in the grand scheme of things. They've still pushed, you know, they're still here at the end of the title race. They're going to finish now probably in the top three, certainly in the top four, and they're going to consider this a season in which they at least challenge the title.
Yeah, I think Wenger's not daft. He knows that next season the teams around Arsenal are probably going to improve as well, because a lot of them have been far below the quality of previous Premier League seasons. So as much as he might have found a midfield two and a goalkeeper, and things might be looking a bit rosier, I still think he needs to add to the squad. Yeah. And he might need to... I wonder whether he might consider cashing in on Fabregas at the end of this season as well.
I think it needs to be said that actually Arsenal have had performances very similar to this one against United in recent seasons. The difference is, perhaps yesterday, was that United weren't as sharp in when they had the opportunity to counterattack as they had been in previous seasons. And that's in part down to, you know, Ramsey being there. Actually, Ramsey is a more, you know, there's lots of things he doesn't give you that Fabregas gives you, but he is a more solid physical presence perhaps than Fabregas is there. And Alex Song played exceptionally, and Gael Clichy played exceptionally, and Laurent Koscielny had one of his better games for Arsenal. So there are elements like that that, you know, perhaps have only gone subtly differently in games against Manchester United in the recent past, but lead to different results. But Fabregas is obviously the big discussion point now. Everyone's going to point at this game and go, oh, look, you know, they beat United without Fabregas, and so can they cope without him? It's obviously massively, massively oversimplistic to say that, and, you know, there's plenty of stats showing that I think Cesc Fabregas has been shown by Opta Joe in the past on Twitter to be, you know, the greatest chance creator in the Premier League, you know, the most sort of consistent creator of goal-scoring opportunities. But, you know, Fabregas has had an up-and-down year. He's been tired after the World Cup, and, you know, he's had his injuries with his hamstring problems. And fundamentally, the real issue at the core is if he wants to go, sooner or later, he's going to go. And perhaps, you know, whilst it's, you know, I don't think you're going to convince me, certainly, that it's necessarily in their interest to lose a player of Fabregas's quality, it may be that now's the time he has to go. And at least this gives you some confidence that Ramsey is capable of stepping in and being a part of that midfield and returning to the levels that he was showing before he got injured. Because before he got injured, he was brilliant.
Yeah, I'm not sure how much he wants to go anymore. I think he feels quite let down by Barcelona from last season, because he sort of pushed the boat out and hung himself out there and made it clear that he didn't want to go, and they didn't stump up enough cash to force Arsenal's hand.
Returning to the title race then, Chelsea 3 points behind United. They picked up 25 points from the last 27 available. They were 15 points behind United not so long ago. It is extraordinary. Now they go to Old Trafford, a game we'll obviously talk a little bit more about on Thursday, but you can't help but look forward to it. And what price is everyone saying? Torres.
I don't think Torres will play, will he? I mean, Chelsea still look a better team when Didier Drogba's in there without Torres alongside him.
To everyone but Ancelotti.
Getting in the way, yeah. Well, this is it. And is this not Ancelotti? Is it still Abramovich who's you know, putting pressure on him to play Torres? But I mean, the best chance of going to Old Trafford and winning is not to play Torres and perhaps bringing him on as a substitute with half an hour to go. Maybe then he could write the story that everybody wants. But the thing is, for Chelsea, they're playing Man United at home. Now, United at home have been very good this season. Had they been playing them at Stamford Bridge, I'd give them a much better chance, because away from home, United had 9 draws and 4 defeats this season, which is incredible, considering...
One of which at Stamford Bridge.
Yeah, one of which at Stamford Bridge. I just think next week it should be a great game, but I still fancy United at home to be the better team.
Right.
I find this home-away thing really interesting, because I can't really get my head around now, when you look at football teams, there's not many stadiums in the Premier League which you go to and think, wow, it's a really intimidating atmosphere, you know, the fans are really on top of you and making it difficult. There's only a handful that you'd put in that category, and even then... And is the travelling that difficult? You know, is it that much of a challenge? Why is there that much of a gap?
I honestly think it's psychological, and that players, you know, when you're in your house, you feel comfortable, don't you? You sat in your chair, there's your favourite plant over there, and your picture of your mother, and you know, and you know where the kitchen is. I make myself a brew if I want at any time. I mean, it's that kind of thing where they look around and this is my home, this is where I am. And despite, you know, the fact that the fans might not be that intimidating, I just think players feel comfortable in their own stadium. They can look up at maybe somebody in a seat and wave to them and that kind of thing. Whereas away from home, they don't get that. They just look around them and maybe, you know, see V signs and, you know, feel a little bit lost. Yeah. And they see advertisements that they don't understand, you know.
Paul, follow that. If you
I did have something saying. I can't remember what it was.
All right.
I was lost in Greg's little world.
It's worth pointing out, perhaps, that Chelsea were a little bit fortunate to overcome Spurs and remain in the box seat. A cracking match it was, but let down by perhaps marred by one or two refereeing decisions and that astonishing howler by Aurelio Gomez.
Yeah,
interesting to see the other London manager who really should go out and sign a new keeper but doesn't get stick for it.
Yeah, especially, does he really need to sign a new keeper, because he's got one of the best backup keepers in the league?
Cudicini,
yeah. And Gomez, how many times has he done that this season? Several.
The Real Madrid game is pretty
The Real Madrid, the United game where he was appealing for a decision and lots of others. But Chelsea are interesting because a bit like United earlier in the season when we were saying that they were winning without playing well, that's been the story of Chelsea's resurgence. They really haven't been playing well recently, and yet they're just racking up the wins. But I guess, are you going to ask me about technology?
I think already knows what they know or believes what they believe about technology, and there was nothing, I think, to convince anyone who believes in technology otherwise dissuade them about it in the game at the weekend.
The only thing that was interesting I thought on that front is that a couple of Chelsea players, John Terry included, were adamant that their photographer had shown them a photo which showed the ball was over the line, which I found sort of fascinating. I couldn't work out if this was that their photographer had just, you know, shaded in a little bit of green on the line next to it so he could show it to their players, or if there is just a photo that actually shows somewhere that it was over the line and that all these other, you know, all this speculation and everything we think we've seen on TV is wrong after all.
It'd be like the Zapruder tape. Only more important, basically.
Maybe John Terry's learnt how to use Photoshop.
yeah, quite possible. A great goal from Sandro.
I guess it depends on how you define the whole of the ball.
Yeah.
Because not all of the ball that was touching the ground when it went over the line.
Right.
But then a bit I agree with that. It is a strange one. The ball wouldn't have been touching the line at all. It'd have been over it, wouldn't it? But then it's the size, you know, just...
It's the end of the ball. It's the whole of the ball has to be over.
Is it possible there's some confusion and John Terry thinks the whole of the ball is the hole in the ball where they put the pump in?
I think that's unlikely, Paolo, but I do see where you're coming from. I just wanted to say what a great goal from Sandro and how nice it was to see Harry Redknapp celebrate that goal so enthusiastically. What was the issue there? Was it Sandro had neglected his defensive duties while scoring a goal that put Spurs in the lead? Possibly.
It was a cracking goal, though.
It was a good goal. Liverpool, with that defeat for Spurs, move into fifth place, Greg.
Yes, and
Channel 5.
Oh, Channel 5. This is the big Channel 5 race, you know, and I don't think anyone's bothered about it, are they?
But really?
Yeah, well, it's an interesting one. I mean, Liverpool, you know, really want to finish fifth, and as I'm sure Spurs do, but the Europa League, to be in the Europa League at the end of it is such a dire competition. And when UEFA, I didn't want to get into this debate really, but when UEFA... created the new brand Europa League, it's kind of like they were creating a Champions League Division 2 or something. It just seems nonsensical not to have a Champions League place for the winner of that, so you bring them both together, and just I think that just reinvigorate the competition, because at the moment, I mean, to finish fifth, there really is no excitement there, is there? You know,
is there none?
Well, you've seen the group
not
games
being
this
in
season.
Europe at all.
Yeah, but I mean, you've seen the group games this season.
Yeah.
And I think it was 4-0 games that Liverpool were involved in. I think City were involved in a similar amount. If there was a Champions
That was
League,
under Roy Hodgson, though.
That was under Roy Hodgson. No, under Dalglish as well, there was a 0-0.
But I take your point. The Europa League is not like being in the Champions League, but it's a lot better, also in terms of attracting players and the prestige of the club, than not being in Europe at all.
No, I'm sure. And you can bring through young players in it as well, but it doesn't seem to work. Like, I mean, even when Liverpool have played some of the younger players under Roy Hodgson in there, there's no excitement.
Isn't the problem that you are trying to use it as a place to blood players? If you took it seriously, then it would be.
The issue is if you take it seriously, and you know, Greg's bang on here, it's such a long competition. If you took it seriously, you will hurt your league form. And actually, I think it's almost the opposite of that. It's not even that, no one's really that interested in it. I think if you listen to Harry Redknapp, you know, it's not hard to read between the lines. He actively doesn't want to be in that competition. He's sort of having to make out, and you know, obviously you try and get to fourth place, there's a chance you end up in fifth, but it seems pretty clear from what he said lately that really, you know, it's the chairman wants to be fifth, but actually I'm pretty clear that we're going to have a better chance of getting back in the Champions League next season if we don't finish in it, because we don't have to worry about thinning our squad into all those games.
This is very disappointing news.
No offence to Bolton as well, but I remember, I think it was 4 or 5 years ago, they said, we don't want to be in this competition, and we're going to play our, you know, players that wouldn't play in the Premier League games, because survival is more important. I mean, that's if there was some kind of reward at the end of it, i.e. you could get the big bucks and get in the Champions League, and it wouldn't be devaluing the Champions League any more than it is already, because there's already teams in the Champions League who aren't champions, then I just think it would completely change that competition and make it more...
I think that's true, but I also think that they need to find a way of either bringing in the big teams at a late stage or just thinning out the number of teams in that competition in total, because it is too much. It's too big at the moment, and having to play that many games to get to the final. And that's the thing, you always see the English teams that are in it. Suddenly, if they get to the quarter final, now we're interested all of a sudden. But up to that point, it's just...
Oh dear. That aside, what about Spurs, eh? The fact that with Man City winning against West Ham, it looks like that top four place may have sailed. How big an impact would it have on Spurs in terms of players leaving, in terms of their finances, missing out on the Champions League?
The first thing I think is the importance of the January transfer window. A lot of people say, well, you don't get it. It's unwise to buy in a transfer window. But their failure to make the Champions League this year shows that perhaps they should have bought in the transfer window. They did try belatedly on the last day when they had this manic spree attempt to buy everyone. But with a bit more planning, they might have been able to get a striker, because that's what they've missed. Somebody to actually put the ball in.
It's funny, though, because when you look at their roster, Defoe, Pavlyuchenko, Crouch, should... You know, there should have been goals there.
Yeah, but there hasn't been. None of those players have played well enough.
Is it a coincidence that all three of them have had a bad season, or could that be something to do with the manager and his tactics?
They played well to get Spurs to the Champions League in the first place last season.
Yeah.
So, and the tactics haven't changed since then, as far as I can see. So maybe they've just they're past their best, all of them. And Pavlyuchenko certainly seems to have motivational issues as well, or just decision-making issues. But they definitely missed a striker. In terms of the question you asked, that will there be a huge exodus? I think the main determining factor in where a player signs is the size of his salary. And
Bednar said as much recently, didn't he? I think he said that he isn't bothered about not getting into the Champions League because players are more bothered about how much you pay them.
Yeah. But if you're not going to be in the Champions League, doesn't that affect your ability to pay the big money?
Well, possibly, but they'll have made the money this season from it to maybe you know, gamble on getting into it next season by bringing those players in.
Well, Spurs are currently 7 points behind Man City, who, like them, have a game in hand on the rest of the division, and they are level on points with Spurs, but with a game in hand. That game in hand, obviously, is against each other, Man City and Spurs. Yeah.
And on the subject of Man City and the Champions League, a lot of people say, no, well, they're going to spend big again this summer because they're going to be in the Champions League, they can attract these players. But I think it's the end of 2012-13 or the 2012-13 season when UEFA say they're going to enforce easier fair play.
I think you can have another big summer splurge this year.
But how they're not going to be able to balance the books, surely, because at the moment UEFA are saying that at this any signings that clubs in Europe are making at this moment
are
going to count towards,
oh, really?
Towards the financial fair play rules. So, I'm just wondering how the hell they're going to, you know, are they just going to spend one season in the Champions League, try and win it, and then just give up, you know, or just go under? I'd just be interesting to see in a season's time where they are.
I think that's just everyone's a bit universally baffled by what's going to happen with that, because Real Madrid are overspending at the moment, aren't they? A lot of the Italian clubs aren't breaking even at the moment, and I think there's more questions than answers with all that sort of stuff at this stage, aren't there? We're going to find out.
All right, then. On that note of uncertainty, let's finish part one. Coming up in part two, Sid Lowe. Is that Sid Lowe?
Yes, it is.
Hi,
hello, James.
Sid. Hi. Welcome, Sid. You join us with part one already under our belts. Part two lying spread out before us there like, well. And how about this weekend in Spain, eh? Real Madrid and Barcelona both losing.
Yeah, Real Madrid and Barcelona both losing, but not only them, also Valencia losing. So you've got, hang on, I'm just going to check my notes because I did actually write this down somewhere to try and make sure I didn't get it wrong. First loss against 12th, second loss against 19th, and third loss against 17th. A difference in points between the two teams of 50, 44 and 28. 125 points difference this is between those sides, and they all lost.
Right. Not that that's not interesting, Sid, but...
It's not interesting, James. No one gives a toss it's all about the Champions League.
Yes. Clasico part four. This time, Sid, it's personal. Now,
it's been personal for a while. It's getting worse and worse and worse and worse.
Yeah. Meat and Veg says, I can't wait to see what happens in next week's thrilling instalment of this weird soap. This, he said, referring to first leg of semi-final, was diarrhea on a stick, but morbid curiosity keeps us enthralled, doesn't it, though? My question to you is a bit like this. Well, the first one is...
First of all, I've got a question.
All right,
how does diarrhea stay on a stick? It needs a certain degree of consistency.
We may find out on Tuesday. We may.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I think they might just dispense of a stick altogether, mightn't they?
Indeed.
But what's the point of a stick? I mean, you know.
As a receptacle for the... I don't know. All good questions, Sid. Here's mine.
To measure the depth of the puddle.
To measure the depth of, as Paul Doyle, of the...
That's
excrement.
True, like a dipstick.
Yeah. Yeah, not that this isn't heading in the direction I'd envisaged, but the build-up from Real Madrid, I'm thinking not the best. First... The internecine warfare going on in their locker room with Cristiano Ronaldo dropped from the team after his fairly mild comments about their tactics against Barcelona. And then this business of reporting, what was it, 6 Barcelona players and Guardiola to UEFA on various spurious charges. I know that this, you know, pull the wagons in a circle thing is meant to be psychologically motivating, but isn't there a point at which you have to just move on from that game and prepare for the next one instead of saying, oh, everyone's against us?
Yeah, I think so. And I think what's so bad about this is that, I mean, I've always said this, that to some extent what players pitch is you know, it's conditioned by the tension that's involved, it's conditioned by the desire to win. The same is almost true as well of Mourinho, even though he's, of course, wound things up enormously and he's a big part of the cause of all the really quite nasty stuff that's going on now. But even he, to some extent, is playing a role about the game. What I think's sort of so distasteful about all of this is the clubs, the institutions that talk constantly, and we're just seeing just, you know, how much nonsense it is. Being gentlemen of clubs, a bit, you know, acting with education, as they always call it, which doesn't really mean education. It means more respect and good manners and civility. And they're just not doing it. And it's so unbelievably petty. I think it's a pretty dangerous precedent as well. There's another thing in all this. We seem to be acting as if, and acting, I suppose, is a word, isn't it? We seem to be acting as if this is the first time anyone's ever seen a game in which players cheated a bit.
I don't know. It just seems a strange kind of victim mentality to which to go into your biggest game of the season.
Now, if they believe that helps, I mean, of course, that plays into it. But this is a victim mentality that's more than just the football side of things. This is a kind of institutional victimism, which I think is showing a distinct lack of class. I think it's showing a lack of intelligence as well. I think it's really quite unpleasant, and it's leading us into a situation where, quite frankly, tomorrow there's a directors' meeting, a directors' meal, as there always is between the two sets of directors before the games. I'd quite like someone to serve up Spurs' lasagna and have them all out of action for a week.
Whoa, then it really would be thingy on a stick, wouldn't it?
It certainly would. But that's probably not on the pitch.
Yeah. Sorry, Paul.
Have you, UEFA, done... anything about this? Because much like their refusal to introduce technology, I think the sort of scenes that we witnessed in El Clasico are just a symptom of the governing authorities' dereliction of duty. There should have been...
Who do you mean, UEFA or UNICEF?
UEFA and FIFA. I mean, there should have been about 74 minutes added on at the end of that match for all the stoppages and play acting. But football authorities just endorse it and have allowed this to become part of the game when it shouldn't be.
Mm. Well, what's happened at the moment, at least in the short term, is that UEFA have a disciplinary meeting today and some decisions will be made based on the fact, of course, that Real Madrid have asked for six players, I think I'm right in saying six players, to be sanctioned by UEFA. There's a refusal, I think, from both sides to see the context of it all, to see the context in which Barcelona's players acted, the context in which Rangers players behaved the way that they did as well. The two clubs are behaving spoilt brats. I think it's really distasteful. UEFA themselves, well, as you say, they refuse to embrace things like technology. I agree with you. There's been so many games I've seen over the years when you think added time, 5 minutes at the end. Added time, we could have 20 minutes at the end of this game for how little the ball's been in. And I also think that you know, we'd be going down a dangerous route, of course, if UEFA were to follow through on Real Madrid's complaints and demands. There's a risk from Real Madrid's point of view that UEFA may say, how dare you, and act more harshly against Real Madrid than act in their favour. I think, in a way, what Real Madrid are doing is fueling that victimism, in that they can say now, if they don't get anything, they say, well, it just proves that UEFA are against us. If they do get anything, then of course it's beneficial for the semi-final. The same is true of Barcelona. Both clubs have put videos now on their websites, which are very pointedly and slightly more directly, in Real Madrid's case, a little bit more kind of subtly, although not particularly subtle in Barcelona's case, basically pointing out that the other guys are the bad guys.
Mm. Sid, the fallout in the meantime to the defeat at the weekend to Real Zaragoza, and the fact that, am I right in saying that Ronaldo was dropped as a kind of a punishment for speaking out about defensive tactics?
Well, we can't know that for certain.
Is that the impression, though?
That's very much the impression.
That's huge, though, isn't it?
It's very, very big indeed, and it's something that the Spanish media ran with as well. It was certainly my interpretation, cautiously and without wanting to go too strong in it, was certainly my interpretation from what Mourinho had said on Friday. He named the squad, and he left out Xabi Alonso, he left out Lassana Diaz, he left out Raul Albiol and Cristiano Ronaldo. Now, when he was asked about these absentees for the game, he explained all of them. He said Alonso and Diarra are absolutely knackered. Now, of course, it helped again to feed into that discourse of victimisation, because he said Alonso and Lassana Diarra are knackered because there was only two of them in the middle of midfield after the sending off for Pepe, and they ran around and they're really tired, and I need to make sure they're fit for Tuesday. So that's those two explained. Raul Albiol, why am I leaving him out? Well, we'll need him on Tuesday. There's no point in playing him because both Sergio Ramos and Pepe, who aren't able to play on Tuesday, are able to play this time round. So they may as well play and give Raul Albiol a rest. And then the question was, Cristiano Ronaldo? And his answer was, my decision. Now, I'm not saying for certain, absolutely, definitely, it's a punishment, but the tone, the refusal to address that particular issue, even though, by the way, I saw some Spanish newspapers add some explanation onto the end of that, which Mourinho never said in the press conference, which I think is very strange. I think the refusal to deal with that, certainly at the very least, Mourinho was letting us know that it could be the case. And one or two of the Spanish papers ran with that idea the following day. And looking at a couple of other sort of minor sort of internal pieces of information, I think that's certainly what it was pointing at.
Now, France, all sorts of news going on there, Paul Doyle.
Yes.
Yes, the FFF allegations. In a nutshell?
Yep. In a nutshell, the allegation is that the technicians and Laurent Blanc, the manager of the national team, were trying to impose quotas on the number of non-white players that could represent France. And this news of a meeting that they held to that effect was leaked by a news website called Mediapart. And they published transcripts of the exchanges, which are quite damning on the people involved. And the government has demanded an inquiry. The federation itself is holding an inquiry. The head of the technical department, the man who replaced Gerard Houllier when he went to Aston Villa, has been provisionally suspended because he was the one who was most in favour of applying this, restricting the number of non-whites in academies throughout the country to around about 30% was one of the suggestions made. And Laurent Blanc, damagingly, appeared to endorse that. And in particular, now he, since taking the job, he two things that he has been, that he's candidly called for is an end to what he perceived as a policy of recruitment in these academies, of concentrating on players who were big, powerful and athletic rather than technically gifted. And so he said that he wanted the focus of recruitment to be put more on technique. And in this meeting, he extrapolated from that we should limit the number of blacks because they are the
people kind
who
of
are,
player.
Yeah. Which is idiotic and very surprising coming from Blanc, because there's never been any suggestion in the past that he's somebody who thinks like that. And indeed, Alou Diarra, who is big, powerful and black, and has been made captain of France by Blanc and was recruited by Blanc at Bordeaux, and Blanc was there, has come out and very much in favour of Blanc and said that he's not that type of guy. And Blanc himself says that his quotes were taken out of context. But as I said, this website has published a transcript of the meeting, and the context didn't seem to be any mitigating circumstances there.
Sorry, they say they also have a recording which they're going to publish. Is that right?
Yeah, they do.
To what extent is all of this a kind of indirect fallout still from the World Cup last year?
To quite a large extent, and from a variety of things, from going back to 2002 when Senegal beat France with a team of players, most of whom were born in France, to I think it was 2001 when France played Algeria in a friendly, and a lot of the Algerian fans who were born in France booed the French national anthem. And so it taps into this whole debate about racism and nationality in
France. And the
France.
Senegal team, a lot of them were presumably trained in the French system, were they?
A lot of them were. That's the other thing I was going to mention that Blanc has been talking about. He's been talking about how ridiculous it is that French academies train all these players who later go on to play for other countries. It has been pointed out that most of these players only go on to play for other countries because France don't select them. Although I did say that, I did see, I think it was one of the newspapers saying that people like Marouane Chamakh and Didier Drogba chose other countries ahead of France, which I thought was stretching a bit. Drogba was born on the Ivory Coast. But apart from being offensive and illegal and morally wrong, it also doesn't make sense, this argument of limiting players who, the suggestion in this meeting was that when players are 12 and 13, we limit the amount of players who can choose to play for two countries.
Who might one day...
We only pick guys of exclusively French background, so not someone who has a parent from Mali or Algeria or whatever. which seems to the idea of saying, well, we'll limit the amount of players that other countries can poach from us at a later date. But in so doing, you also limit the amount of players at your own disposal. And of course, as we know, players of varied backgrounds have done extremely well for France in recent years and have been a major part for them becoming a force in football. So it's self-defeating as well as being morally wrong, as I say.
Isn't the skin colour issue a bit of a red herring then? Because, I mean, you know, there's plenty of players who might have white skin who have got, you know, parents from different countries.
Yeah, and that's what, in this meeting, there was one guy who spoke against it, a guy called Francis Smerdecki, who's the manager of France's under 20 teams, who has Polish antecedents. And he pointed that out, and of course then they said, no, this isn't about colour, it's just about
Blanc,
technique.
Though, specifically, in the transcripts, Blanc appears to specifically mention black players being a certain kind of player, which we have too much of. Is there any suggestion that Gerard Houllier has contributed at all to this mindset or not?
No. Okay. One of the things, because François Blacard, who has been suspended, said in that meeting that they are already applying this policy in the famous Clairefontaine Institute. He said, I've already given orders for this quota to be applied. And one thing that the government investigation is to get to the bottom of is whether or not that's true. He also said, or maybe it was one of the other participants in the meeting who said that various French clubs, including Lyon and Marseille, are already applying it. And they've come out and said that's absolute nonsense. And they've invited journalists to come and see the composition of their academies to see that they are, as diverse as the rest of the country.
All right. Well, a very unpleasant business.
But what it does, though, yeah. I think, because it has implications beyond France, I think, because what it does is it shows that international football is an anachronism, and in this diverse world, making somebody choose one country it's almost a false dichotomy, George Bush style false dichotomy. You're either with us or against us.
All right, let me quickly ask you. You did mention Lyon and Marseille. They're a bad weekend for them. Are Lille back on top? Little Lille?
Yes, they are. They're a point clear of Marseille, who only drew, and Lyon lost. So it's a two-horse race with an advantage. Lille, who Moussa Sow, who's a top scorer in the league, is one of the people around whom this debate is being hung, because he was born in France and plays for Senegal.
Right, having been trained in Clairefontaine.
Yeah, or in one of the academies.
Okay. All right, then. Okay, in Germany, Borussia Dortmund already clinched the title with two games to spare. That's their seventh national title and their first since 2002. Bayern Munich moving back into third spot, the last Champions League spot, after a 4-1 victory over Schalke. Hanover losing against Borussia Mönchengladbach.
With Schalke losing, that means all four teams in the Champions League semi-finals this weekend.
Correct. Yeah. All right. Italy. No danger of that happening there.
No.
No. Milan all but sealed it now, Paolo.
Yeah. It's basically done. There's three games left, and Milan need a point. Little Mattia Flamini popping up with the decisive goal this weekend.
Nice to see the San Siro packed out like that. Some reports said 80,000, which I find hard to believe, given that the capacity is slightly less than that. But
I mean, you know, these numbers. I'm often a bit befuddled by the attendance numbers that come out in Italy. Sometimes they seem far too low, sometimes far too high. But yeah, I mean, it was packed, it was rocking, and you know, I think at the end, it's just so clear that Milan have deserved the title this season. I mean, they've been top for almost the entire campaign. They've actually been a really impressive little run of five wins in a row now, which included, you know, thumping Inter. And the last two games they've won without Ibrahimovic, without Pato, who are their two, you know, top scorers this season. So, you know, they're the best team in Serie A this season, and they're going to win it. And Adriano Galliani was just about the only person in the stadium, I think, at the end, who was saying, well, now hang on a second, we haven't won it yet. Because Berlusconi was there, and he was straight down to the changing room to celebrate for the best part of an hour. And just generally, I think most people have acknowledged now that this one's run its course.
All right, Inter kept it not mathematically certain with an amazing come-from-behind win against Cesena, two injury-time goals from Pazzini. They do a lot of that, don't they? Milan, meantime, can seal it this weekend at Roma, who are now right back in the race for fourth. Lazio are a point ahead of them and Udinese. Lazio face Udinese next weekend. Lazio do have a game in hand, though, is that right?
Well, they have a game in hand, which is tonight against Juventus, who up until last weekend also thought they were in the race for fourth, probably just about out of it now, but certainly going to be a tasty game this evening. So, Lazio have a couple of really big games the next couple of weekends. And, Roma, it's huge now, because obviously the Americans want to be in the Champions League. They want that money. It's all part of their vision for what happens next for the club. But interesting to see Francesco Totti, who I slammed on this podcast earlier in the season, has been in cracking form. And he scored two goals this weekend proceeded at the end. He took off his shirt because he'd surpassed Roberto Baggio as the fifth all-time scorer in Italy. And he took off his shirt to show a T-shirt saying... the King of Rome is not dead. The King of Rome is not dead.
In English.
Indeed, because an English
in golden letters.
Yeah. An English commentator had said that recently. It was during the Rome derby, actually, against Lazio. So yes, he was they're making a big show of himself. But, fair play. He's been absolutely, he's the reason they're back in the race, actually, the top four. Totti has been in very good form.
Four braces in the last seven games, I think. He is now fifth, as you say. Giuseppe Meazza and Jose Altafini, 10 goals ahead of him. So you can see him maybe moving into third place. Excuse me. I want curly hair too. Says, how is Totti seen in Italy outside Roma? He's fifth on the all-time Serie A goalscorers list, etc. From the outside looking in, it seems he isn't considered, though, one of the greats in the rest of Italy compared to the likes of Inzaghi and Del Piero.
I don't think that's true. Totti, it's not so long ago that because Italian teams used to negotiate all their TV contracts individually. It's not so long ago that Totti, the TV contracts that Roma signed would be entirely dependent on him staying at the club. They wouldn't. The TV companies would write that into contracts. So no, I think he's pretty big.
Yep. Had his wedding televised live on national TV.
Just everywhere in adverts.
That one the other week, wasn't it?
Yeah. No, I enjoyed that one actually.
Did you?
Yeah.
Joyless. It was a joyless affair, wasn't it?
Yeah. There was joy to be found if you were looking for it, I think, Greg.
I had a Joy Division t-shirt on.
Did you?
Yeah.
Right, okay.
Tried to get in the mood.
Hmm?
And there was a vicar who did a cartwheel afterwards.
That was exciting, wasn't it? Down at the bottom, blah, blah, blah. Big fight back from Sampdoria, but it's ever so tight there. There's still only a point off the drop.
Well, that was almost the most significant part of that Inter comeback against Cesena. Cesena was sort of... That win would have taken them right out of it. It really would have been one less team in the relegation race, but obviously now they're back in it. And Samp scoring three goals, which I find baffling given how
Fiorentina
few they scored
scoring
recently.
Five.
Yeah, but Fiorentina are a team capable of scoring goals, but Sampdoria, that's about equals their output since November, just about.
Very true, very true. There you go. Everything to play for in the final three games, and that huge Lazio-Juventus game coming up Monday night. We're going to be talking about the Championship and the Premier League relegation battle after this. Championship. This weekend, QPR winning promotion to the Premier League with the 2-0 win over Watford. Although there is, of course, this caveat. Alejandro Forlan, is that how you say it?
Forlan,
right.
I thought it was Foulin.
Foulin.
Yeah.
Something like that. One of the many questions the FA will be deciding on.
One makes him sound blonde and tanned, and the other one makes him Chinese.
Sound like Chinese. Yeah, Forlin.
Yeah.
I don't know. Anyway, he... And there are something like, seven counts of doing things wrong when they signed him? Yep. And,
That's
it's all very technical.
Yeah.
And I don't know. And it does seem strange that a team would be docked points unless, they'd fielded 12 men or something. I'm not sure if I really go along with the kind of moral outrage behind this one. But are they going to be... Is their promotion going to be jeopardised by this, Paul, is it?
Well, I mean, obviously, if they are docked points...
But is that going to happen, do you think? Or are they? Is he
going to
be slapped on the wrist?
He's played in every match almost this season.
Yeah.
So it's not like previous instances of players who've only made fleeting appearances.
Well, Tevez made a huge impact on West Ham staying up. And here's Dublin Roo, for example. If the FA deduct points, RB effing raging. Didn't they make a skin-crawlingly cringeable statement at the time of West Ham's event saying that it would be unfair to punish their wonderful fans? Are some fans more important than others now? Are they?
I don't know about that. I do think it's strange how it's sort of been allowed to get this late.
Yeah.
Now it sort of feels like they can just sort of wait and see any points QPR get, then deduct an amount that's meaningless.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
I think they've been gathering loads of evidence, haven't they? I mean, it looks like it's been complicated, and it's probably taken a lot of time to get this evidence together. And now they need to do it very quickly before the playoffs so they know where QPR stand.
But if it's such a big deal, if it's such the kind of outrage that would require a team to lose its promotion one on the field. You'd think it would be clear-cut enough for them to go, well, that's wrong, and therefore we're going to do this. If it's a technicality, then just, I don't know.
Or maybe they're looking at just how bad it's been. If there's, like you said, there's been these seven different things that have happened, which have built up, then perhaps they're looking at how just how many points they can deduct.
Unless he's playing with rockets in his boots.
Well, yeah, but it's really a technicality that after the Tevez affair, they said they were going to clamp down on particularly hard. So if they're to have any credibility, they have to do that.
It's not like he's been wearing a snood in all these matches. In that case, I say drop him to dreadful, League One.
I mean, and the FA in the past have banned teams, like the non-league teams, who fielded a player for 2 minutes as a substitute from the FA Cup, and they've actually just thrown them out because of this. So they're pretty hardline on this kind
Torquay
of stuff.
Torquay were dropped or docked points, weren't they, for playing a guy in one game?
That's true, earlier this season.
Yeah.
Not only them, another team as well, but the name of which escapes us. Oh, well. Bernie Eccleston, I like this from colleague Simon Burnton today. He says, where he quotes all Bernie Eccleston's comments about how he doesn't like going to football matches, and when he does go, he leaves at half time because then you can see which way the game's going and you don't get your car held up by Roblox or anything. He didn't go to the game at Watford, in which they putatively won promotion.
He said, too far away, wasn't it?
Yeah, he said, I wouldn't go to Watford to see the World Cup. And Simon says, welcome to the top flight, Bernie. It might take the Formula One controlling maestro a while to get used to a competition where the leader might actually get overtaken. Norwich City will also clinch promotion on Monday if they defeat Portsmouth and Middlesbrough beat Cardiff City. The first part of that you can see happening. Not sure about Borough beating Cardiff City, but those games coming up later on Monday. At the other end of the Championship, Sheffield United now down. They'll be joined in League One by Scunthorpe, who lost heavily to Nottingham Forest. Southampton moving closer to promotion from League One. And Bournemouth into the promotion playoffs definitely now. So, which, given the season they've had, I'm here to tell you, it's very impressive indeed. No, they've had a very difficult season, producer Ben. Financial difficulties, a transfer embargo, their manager leaving halfway, the loss of two of their top scorers.
Yeah, their young manager left, didn't he? Was it Eddie Howe?
Eddie Howe, yeah.
He was brilliant.
And it's all extraordinary. Good. Meantime, there are clubs battling to avoid joining the Championship. And who came out better of the relegation strugglers this weekend? You had your Wigan drawing with Everton, Blackpool goalless with Stoke, West Ham losing at Man City in a match they probably didn't think they were going to get any points from, Blackburn winning, and Wolves with that point at Birmingham.
I think Wolves will really regret not making the most of Birmingham going down to 10 men, because if they'd have got that win, I think they'd have been on 36 points, and they seem to have the more winnable games of the final three. They're playing West Brom at home, Sunderland away, and Sunderland have been awful, like they've just given up this season. And then Blackburn away is the final game of the season.
Could be a tough one, actually.
Well, it could be. By that point, Blackburn might be safe, though, as well.
Blackburn next play West Ham, then they have Man United, who are probably going to be needing points, and then they're away to Wolves, Blackburn.
So
I think Blackburn have probably the worst run-in of all of them.
I've written down here what I think will happen.
All right, okay,
at the end.
Cool.
Okay, right. I've got Blackburn drawing with West Ham, losing to Man United, and then losing to Wolves in the final game, which leaves them on 39 points.
Right.
Blackpool, I've got losing to Spurs away. I've got them beating Bolton at home, losing to Man United at home. That leaves them on 38 points. I've got Wigan losing to Villa away, winning against West Ham at home, and drawing with Stoke away. That leaves them on 39 points. And then Wolves have got them winning against West Brom at home in the Black Country Derby, beating Sunderland away, and then losing to Blackburn, which leaves them on 40 points. Are you still with me?
Yeah. Yep.
And then West Ham have got beating Blackburn at home, losing against Wigan away, and then beating Sunderland at home, which leaves them on 38 points. So that means that Blackpool and West Ham will go down, and it'll be between Wigan and Blackburn on goal difference. Now, I haven't got a table, so
you've got Wolves surviving. Course.
I've got Wolves. I've got Wolves surviving.
I'd have said Blackpool to beat Bolton on the form Blackpool are on is quite a big call, and West Brom also. They're going to be plenty motivated to beat Wolves, even if they're already safe now.
I'm not saying you should listen to what I'm saying and kind of take me seriously. I'm just that's what I've got down there, you know. Yeah,
let's just set your own one if you like, Paolo.
I should.
Listeners, why not try this game at home?
We're going to on -23 at the moment, and Blackburn are on -14. So basically, even with Blackburn's games that they've got, it'll be Wigan that go down. I've got Blackpool, West Ham, and Wigan going down, and Blackburn staying up on goal difference.
All right,
and Wolves.
Interesting.
And going down to the bookies now, Greg's telling me what's
Let
happening.
Me just tell me that again. So it's West Ham. Who's going down?
West Ham,
yep.
Blackpool,
yep.
And Wigan on goal difference with Blackburn surviving on the same points.
Of course, you know now you've made enemies of three teams' fans who are going to sit there and wait, and if one of them gets out,
yeah, Jacob Stein,
they're coming after you.
Headbutt me when they get this game.
Right. Yeah. He's quite ripped as well, isn't he, Jacob Stanley? He works out.
Yeah, yeah. He boxes. I box as well now. Maybe we could get a three-rounder on.
You know. Tom's doing a bit of boxing as well, isn't he?
Tom likes.
Sean Ingle's been boxing for ages.
Yeah, I fought.
There's surely a Guardian tournament waiting to happen.
Yeah, I fought Sean Ingle the other day. Yeah.
Did you?
Yeah. He's a more experienced boxer than me. He's got a better reach, but I think in body sparring, we were kind of... He'd beat me on points, you know, but I don't think he could knock me down.
The thing about Sean Ingle, he's the kind of fighter, I think, who wouldn't know when he's beaten. He just, not because he's brave, he just actually wouldn't know. So he'd keep going. Sometimes he wouldn't fire. Yeah. Stop, it's over. You
know? But I think Sean could probably batter anybody on the street, but because he's such a kind of nice guy, he just wouldn't, and he'd just let somebody kind of just kick his head in, yeah.
Right, okay. Interesting. One day we really ought to get...
I think this is a Guardian extra event waiting to happen.
Yeah, it certainly is. And I bet there are a lot of... I mean, tell Matt Hall, because when he hears about the demand for tickets, it's going to happen, I'm sure. I have to say, I know that one shouldn't have favourites and that, but you know, I don't want Blackpool to go down. You know, not with everything they've overcome, poor things, and their minuscule budget and their attractive brand of football. I know... All cliches and stuff.
I think Wolves will go down.
You think they will?
They've just made such a habit of shooting themselves in the foot consistently all throughout the campaign.
Blackpool have got...
Yesterday there was a prime example. Yeah, both in the way they conceded the goal.
Yeah.
And then for the last hour against Birmingham's 10 men, they didn't create a single chance, which is quite damning.
It's a worry, that, isn't it? Because the weekend before, midweek, the game against Stoke, he was seemed almost mystified and bewildered by the lack of application in his team.
Yeah, well, there wasn't a lack of application.
Well,
so
he
much
said
as,
that he thought it was the...
I didn't, and that much, right. Perhaps, but right. in yesterday's game, it wasn't a lack of application. It was a lack of quality and a lack of, perhaps, of self-belief. And also a lack of, you could argue, of Milias, who is a creative midfield player who McCarthy left on the bench throughout. When it was crying out for someone to just prise open that well-organised Birmingham defence.
Just to go back to Blackpool, they've conceded an average of 2 goals a game this season, so as much as they've been entertaining and a breath of fresh air, they've not been able to defend all season. There's only one team who's got a worse defensive record in the 92 in the professional teams, and that's Stockport, who are 92nd, who've conceded 95 goals in 45 games. Blackpool have conceded 70 in 35, so there you go.
70 goals?
70 goals in 35, so they've conceded 2 goals a game.
Yeah.
Which was, of course, the thing yesterday. Yesterday or Saturday, Blackpool? Saturday, yeah. It was their first clean sheet, but also the first time they failed to score at home.
Yeah, interesting, huh? There you go. Well, it sets up for a remarkable finale to the season. And Thursday we'll be looking forward to the next chapter, which is that big Man United-Chelsea clash at Old Trafford. And, of course, reviewing all those Champions League semi-finals. Delicate affairs they are, in the balance. Many thanks in the meantime to producer Ben, to Greg Ruffley, Paolo Bandini and Paul Doyle, and you listeners. We'll be back, as I say, later in the week. See you then.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.